Welcome, everybody, to our podcast On the First Tee, where we look at a view of golf from behind the scenes. My name is Ian Butcher. I am the program lead at SRUC in golf course management, and my co-host.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Matthews, a lecturer in sustainable golf course management, an occasional weekend greenkeeper in St. Andrews, and as always, a forever hopeful golfer.
So why are we here, Ben? And what can the listeners expect? In our work at SRUC, we always talk about how we believe that golf is a force for good. We're passionate about the game of golf, and we're very lucky because we meet people all the time who are working in various roles behind the scenes, and they share with us and our students their expertise, they share their career journeys, but we've found that they're also sharing the love of what they're doing and where they're working. And we thought, why not share it?
And Ian, we have found that talking with this network of incredible people is always compelling. So it made perfect sense to invite these stakeholders at golf onto a podcast to discuss the issues that matter to them and the happiness that they've found in their careers within this industry. The podcast also gives us a great opportunity to highlight the outstanding careers that can be found within the game of golf, from the traditional to the new and emerging. We think all of these things are worth talking about, and we hope you do too. So please join Ian and myself on the First Tee for a view of golf from behind the scenes.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of On the First Tee with myself, Ian Butcher, and my co-host, Ben Matthews.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And I'm so happy to be connecting to the beautiful continent of Africa today. We are so lucky to have Andrew McKenna, who is the founder and director of the African Turf Academy. And thanks again for joining us on this sunny, sunny day, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. It's 32 degrees in
Here we go.
But the thunderstorms are rolling in for this afternoon to hit us now.
They're apparently
going to be quite heavy this afternoon.
If I could just introduce Andrew by saying the African Turf Academy is a part of SRUC. And so we talk quite regularly. And then pretty much at the beginning of every chat that Andrew and I will have, he will share with us, you know, his idyllic scenery that he's living in, his idyllic lifestyle and what he's drinking at that particular time. I don't know what it is right now, Andrew, maybe a Sauvignon for you, is it?
If we can just skip over it
today and get straight to it. Andrew, your insight to us is very valuable because you have an experience of being a player. You know, of being a tour player. And I think we'll get to it by just asking you, like we ask everybody really, when did you start falling in love with golf? What age did you start playing? Why did you start playing? Where did you start playing? How did playing golf all begin with you?
Well, I mean, my parents, my dad got moved around a lot when I was a kid, but I played every sport under the sun, football, tennis, cricket, you name it. And then one summer, we were living in Belgium, Brussels. My dad was working there and my mum said to me that there's this golf camp thing going on at the school and she enrolled me and that was it. All the other sports were gone. I was about 13, 14. And then we moved back to England soon after that and I lived in Surrey for a couple of years and then my parents moved to Dumfries in Scotland where I then was just obsessed with golf. And then I went to an academy in London called Marestwood College, where we did our PGA qualification, and I just focused on golf. And by the time I got to 23 and 1997 European Q School, I got my European, I got a playing category on the European Tour.
So that took about 10 years. I think that's quite late, is it? Starting at 13, 14?
Yeah. So it's a lot later than some, and probably I relate high level sport to learning a language. You lose out if you don't learn it when you're really young. You don't have all the skills that you probably need, and it caught up with me eventually that I just didn't have the intricate skills. Maybe I don't know. There's many many different reasons why I may or may not have, well, I didn't make it as a player, and I tried, but I don't have any regrets. It's like my probably one regret is I played one or 2 years too long. It was clear by the time I was 27, 28 that I wasn't going to make it, even though I was kept playing on Challenge Tour and Tartan Tour and Sunshine Tour and the odd European Tour event here and there. But it was just getting more and more away from me. So then I wish I'd gone into the business of golf, because I love the business of golf.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, let's just go back a little bit. I mean, just for those young people that are listening and do still aspire to be playing, you know, as a tour golfer, what's the key ingredient of for success if you're going to make that transition from a teenager, let's say, that loves the game of golf and is practicing day and night, to actually getting to the point where you're getting a tour card? And I think this is where we met, and this is where we agree with each other. You know, there's hundreds of these kids out there, and thousands of these kids out there. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely not one answer to that question. At our academy, the African Surf Academy, is one component of the academy. We've got a participation part where we're trying to grow the game, and then we've got the performance part where we're trying to get the good young players being great. We have an incredible amount of talent in South Africa, and my son is number 9 under 19 player in South Africa, and he's 16. And he's asking me those questions. Another fortunate thing we have at Silver Lake, where we're based, is we've got so many successful professionals playing here, practicing it. Tristan Lawrence, Sean Norris, Louis Diaga, George Katsia. You know, and there's multiple. There's probably, out of those just four names, there's probably 12 to 15 European Tour titles, never mind Japanese Tour titles, Sunshine Tour titles. So these kids are seeing that it can be done.
Yeah.
For me, practicing at Powerfoot Golf Club in Dumfries, I didn't know anyone who was even, I was quite fortunate there as well, because the Scottish Boys Champion was a year older than me and he was a member there. So but that's not the same as Sean Norris and George Casilla and Tristan Lawrence, who came third in the Open Championship last year at Troon. He played in the final two ball. The youngsters, they are practicing unbelievably hard. They're gymming. They're playing a lot of tournaments. They are they're getting their equipment right. They've got more data than they've ever had before. They're using the flight scopes, the TrackMan. But ultimately, it comes down to nerve and execution under pressure, you know, and who has that, you know, and you don't know that until it comes.
Andrew, just out of curiosity, would you say it's probably harder to crack into any of the tours now than it was sort of when you were trying to do that? And because of all these things that you said, the data, you know, they're getting in more rounds, there's sort of that more pressure. Do you think that along with the growth of the game, more people are aware of it, more people trying to get on, is it harder now than ever to get onto a tour?
I don't think so. I think it's much of a muchness. I think it was hard then. It's hard now. I mean, I said to my son the other day, you're so lucky. You've got all this data. You know exactly what shafts you need in your clubs. And I took him down, because Titleist now sponsor him. And I took him down to their fitting headquarters. And he got all the newest clubs with the latest shafts and the loft and lies and he said you're so lucky. He said, but everybody's getting that now, and in my day nobody had it. The playing fields are level then and now. So it's hard to compare that era to now. There were so many amazing players in my era. I mean, Westwood and Rose and Poulter and Donald and Casey and then just ahead of them, there was Faldo and Woosnam. And, you know, it's there were probably more superstars back then. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But there's more different winners these days, probably. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know.
I just want to come in there for a couple of things. For people that are listening to this podcast, it might be a good idea to check out the African Turf Academy website either before, during, or after this podcast to get a flavor of what Andrew's actually doing down there, because this is going to be the emphasis of the conversation. And secondly, we this podcast focuses on recreational golf. We're not going to drag Andrew into a conversation about the LIV Tour or the PGA Tour or any other tour. That's not the role of this podcast, just to lay that down.
Or US politics. I don't want to talk about US politics.
Absolutely not.
No, exactly. So, but that journey, I'm just really interested in that journey. And I just want to take you back to, because we're interested in communities of learning. When you were talking about how you're surrounded down there in Silver Lakes with so many people that are excelling at what they do. In other walks of life, you can see this. Yeah, you see it in Silicon Valley. You know, you see it in finance in places like London. So it is a case, isn't it, that if you're in one of these hotbeds of excellence, you know, geographically speaking, you know, it's got to be a good thing for your prospects rather than, you know, the outer reaches of Dumfries.
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, these juniors that are coming out of our club are driving each other on.
Yeah.
First of all, because there's a good few of them, and secondly, the end goal is tangible. They're putting with these guys in the afternoon, who won the Alfred Dunhill Trophy at Leopard Creek recently, and George Casillas won 5 times in the European Tour. I think Sean's won 10 times on the Japanese tour. Anyway, yeah, so relating back to my journey, I tried to be a pro, but I went to a college and studied my PGA qualification as a backup. And when I decided I couldn't make a living playing, it was quite a transient point in my life. One friend said to me, he may not remember saying it to me, he just said, he gave me one bit of advice. He said, stick to what you know. And I was thinking at that time, should I become an estate agent? What should I do? So I went into golf coaching, and then it sort of sparked my enjoyment of the industry of golf, not so much the profession of playing golf.
So you established McKenna Academies, which was a coaching program, yeah?
Mm.
And that was successful. And did you do that, you know, in Africa? Is that when you moved to Africa?
So I coached for a few years with Doug McClelland at Silver Mere in Surrey, which is a very big golf complex, massive pro shop. That was just because it was the first time in my life I'd ever had any guaranteed money. You know, playing golf, there's no guaranteed money at all. You're paying out to go to these tournaments and you come home with nothing, or maybe you play well and you win £10,000. You just don't know. So I've started coaching, and then in 2008, so this was going from 2003 to 2008 when I moved to South Africa. And I was very, very fortunate, and I put it down to fortune and making it happen. I got given the contract to run the golf academy at Silver Lakes Golf Estate, which I've held the contract with them for the last 15 years. And African Turf Academy was when I first thought about it. I reached out to you on a blind email into the internet kingdom.
Well, let's get on to that then. So we've got a coaching academy established, a successful one, but then you're not content with that. You were motivated to create, and for just cut to the chase here, you know, Andrew runs an academy down there, which enables really good golfers to have something to fall back onto, which is the turf management program. And that's what we're going to get into a bit later. But what was the story there to say that it's not enough to just have a coaching academy? You wanted to do something for these kids beyond coaching.
Well, I mean, it's the responsibility of having an academy with a kid who has a dream, but the chance of it becoming real is so slim. So I was like, I don't want to charge, because you can easily run a coaching academy down here, have no education with it, and the kids will enroll with you. But after 2 years, they leave, and then they haven't made it as a player, and they've got nothing to show for it. So I was racking my brain, lying in bed at night, thinking, what can I don't want to do the PGA program because that's been done, that's been copied and pasted in various locations, an academy with the PGA. And really, it was just, again, it was a little bit of luck. And I reached out to you and I reached out to Jim Croxton at Bigger, who I give him a hard time every time I see him, that he never responded. It was Ian that responded the day later.
In defense to Jim, it is my job to respond to you. I don't know whether it was his job, but anyway.
No, but it's something that I chirp Jim about when I see him. Anyway, so we've got a good relationship now. We started the journey then, and you came down to see it and check it out and enjoy some of the Stellenbosch vineyards.
I was inspired by more than that. I was inspired by your vision, Andrew, and because I think it's a very important message for parents, families across America, Europe, Africa, Asia. We're seeing it all the time. You know, these kids dreaming of this television experience, you know, which we've already covered, is such an elite thing. And what have they to fall back on if it doesn't work? And that's where I was, you know, so passionate to support you and continue to support you, because I think it's such an important model that you've developed down there, and you are now being, you know, copied elsewhere.
But the thing is, now it's completely flipped. It doesn't attract the good young player who wants to study on the side. We have had a few of them over the years, but it's become such a sort of a solid academic, practically based journey with international work opportunities and connections with Michael Kiefer at Ohio State and Simon Doyle at Troon Golf and many courses around Europe that it's really not that anymore. That's what it started off as, but it's not that anymore. The industry have really...
You're talking about the turf management industry here.
The African Turf Academy and the industry of greenkeeping and managing golf courses here.
It's becoming so well thought of that people are just coming to you just to go into that career direction alone.
Yeah, but they still, I still encourage the golfing side of the program. Some guys are like, I don't think I need to play golf. But I'm saying, no, you need to understand the game that you're preparing a golf course for. So if you don't understand the game that, you know, I'd say I relate it to cricket. If you don't understand how a ball swings and bounces in a cricket pitch, how can you be prepare the Lord's cricket ground for a test match? You know, it's the same. It's not just a garden. You're preparing a golf course.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting argument, and it's one that I know that Ian kindly drilled into us as students. I'm one of Ian's previous students myself. And it makes sense to me. You know, you've got to play the game to understand how you prepare and present these surfaces. There's still, and maybe it's the older guys in greenkeeping, and maybe it's just the older guys at the particular venue I work at, which I won't name, but where they just convince you, just, you don't need to. And I was speaking to one of the old guys the other day. I said, don't you think it offers you a better perspective, though? Don't you think it offers you a bit more, you know, it's a better understanding, it's a broader understanding. And he said, would you want Lewis Hamilton coming in and wrenching on the engine and then driving the car? I thought, that's apples and oranges, mate.
Yeah, I mean the thing that the guys will say is you don't have to. No, of course you don't have to. But it just gives you an extra edge. And I'm not talking about becoming an ex-European tour player. And those guys tend not to want to be greenkeepers. Very few guys who are pro golfers revert to greenkeeping. But it's the guy who plays off 5 or 6 or 8 or 12 or anything sort of like that, who enjoys the game, understands the game, understands bunkering, course layout, playability. Never mind the agronomy side of it.
I would agree 100%. And just thinking about sometimes when the new guys come in, and not necessarily the younger guys, but just new guys in the greenkeeping that I've worked with, and you can tell when they play or they don't play, and it's sort of their first week, and they're helping you with course setup. And if they don't play the game, they've set up the tees facing almost like 90 degrees the wrong way. Where are they teeing off to?
So it's not an essential, but I with our enrollment sort of levels these days, we're not scratching around for students, which we were in years one and two. In the first year, we had three students. Now we have 40 students over the 2 years. So we don't take more than that because of the just the for two reasons. You wouldn't want to flood the market. I don't think the market could be flooded, but don't want to. And secondly, the golf club that we're based at, Silver Lakes, we don't want to disturb the members too much, you know, by taking over.
Yeah, I remember laughing with you a few years ago, Andrew, about a conversation about not allowing anybody onto the program if they don't play golf, which is too extreme for us. We're not allowed to do that because we want people to access the program. But yeah, I always thought it was a good idea. But that's biased, I think.
I wouldn't say I do that. I would say I encourage the performance. You get guys who just want to study. We've got a couple of guys who just want to study who are working in the industry already, and they want to do the qualifications alongside it. And they're very much the old school greenkeeping, you know.
Sorry to interrupt. What are they falling in love with then? Are they falling in love with the theory and science of agronomy and the studies?
You did. But you still love playing golf, though.
Well, we just explained to the audience that the podcast is called On the First Tee. Okay. And we think it's an emotional expression because what a wonderful thing to say to somebody. You know, I'll see you on the first tee. Yeah, that immediately, for those of us that play golf, raises our spirits. We know what's coming and we're going to have a fantastic time. It is not, from my experience, called the 18th green. Because if it's on the 18th green, in my experience, then I'm angry. I'm very, very disappointed. I'm usually looking for something to kick. And I will probably, you know, destroy a liter of hard liquor to try to get away from the memories. So, yes, Andrew, I love playing golf up to a point. But when you don't play very well, you know, you have a love-hate thing with it. And at the moment, I'm having a love-hate thing with it.
Don't we all?
Do we?
How many times have you said you never want to play golf again, Ian?
I've never said that. I've said I just want to understand it a bit better.
Maybe I'm never going to destroy a liter of alcohol again. Maybe that.
I've said that a few times, yeah.
Okay, let's take a quick break there, and we'll hear from SRUC about their upcoming exhibit at the 2025 Royal Highland Show.
Heading to the Royal Highland Show this year? Don't miss your chance to discover the future of SRUC and have a bit of fun whilst you're at it. Come and visit us on 7th Avenue, right beside the main show ring. Whether you're curious about courses, careers, or just up for some interactive fun, then we've got something for everyone. Come and hook a Hilda or try your hand at the welding simulator. Have a swing at mini golf with SRUC putts or learn to save a life with some animal CPR. Visit local producers at our alumni farmers market Saturday or explore our show garden for a burst of inspiration. You'll meet our brilliant teams from Vet Services, the School of Veterinary Medicine and SSE Consulting, plus chat to student ambassadors and our Students Association for potting your very own plant. Whether you're into science, sustainability, animals or agriculture, or just want to know where your future could grow, come and find out more about our courses, research and student life. SRUC. Find your place, grow your future.
All right, let's get back to the podcast with some thoughts from Andrew about the state of golf in South Africa. Ian, take it away.
What's the state of the game there? While we've got you, Andrew, what's the state of the game down in South Africa then? And are we talking? Do you talk in terms of South Africa as a nation state, or do you talk in terms of Southern Africa? You know, and draw a line above it. And either way, you know, what's the state of the game in that region of the world?
I think South Africa is very strong, very popular. All the clubs are thriving. There's so many amazing facilities down here. In Africa, so we do some work with the RNA across Africa online. Africa is such a huge geographical area. And you have golf courses dotted around, and they'll be dotted in sort of mining towns in Zambia or even the DRC. And then you've got language problems in some countries speak French and Portuguese. And it's hard to say in Africa how much it's growing. We're trying hard to try and get the greenkeeping a little bit better to try and grow the game that way. But in South Africa, it's very strong.
Very strong.
British Amateur Championship. Three of the last six British amateur champions are South African.
Yeah.
But that was another area where we did bond, wasn't it? You had an understanding as being an ex-player, how important the golf course conditioning was to the financial success of golf clubs. You took me to a couple of venues that had failed, and a lot of it could be put down to the fact that the management of the golf course wasn't in place, and therefore the customer experience wasn't in place. So you understood that as an ex-player, and that's your contribution, I think, to African golf, is to try to deliver, you know, a high quality playing experience.
Yeah, absolutely. That's to educate the guys to become knowledgeable enough to deliver the best possible golfing surfaces within the budgets that are available to them. You know, so it doesn't, in South Africa, there's a lot of golf estates where Silver Lakes is one of them. Here we have 1700 homes inside a golf estate. There's many of these, and the homeowners contribute a levy towards the upkeep of the golf course. Not a lot, maybe £10 a month each, but that that creates enough of a buffer to contribute to the operations of the course, because they also get to enjoy the golf course. I mean, St Andrews is somewhat a golf estate. It's like a big town that surrounds golf courses, in the golf course in the town, and all the community have the privilege of walking the links land in their social time. It's a beautiful thing to enjoy the nature of a golf course, even if you're a non-golfer.
Yeah.
Oh, without a doubt. And that might take us into another conversation. But just bringing it back to the accessibility of the game in your part of the world. So the Scottish model here is very interesting. The local people play for very affordable rates. The visitors are paying more, let's put it that way, considerably more. So is that what's happening in Africa? You know, the locals playing because it's affordable. How affordable is it? And are there many visitors coming in that are subsidizing the locals playing?
Depends what you mean by locals. There's obviously various demographics that are going on in South Africa and the different levels of, in the economy.
Understood. I'm talking about people. Yeah, that's a very good point. I'm talking about people that are likely to play golf.
Yeah, if you're in the demographic that you can play golf, golf is affordable in South Africa. It's not cheap,
okay,
but
it's not exorbitant. No.
It costs me about, like, for my son who plays unlimited golf a year, it costs me about £300, and he can play as much golf as he wants and hit as many balls on the range as he wants, and he goes round and round and round and round all day, all year long, for about £300.
Yeah, very good. That's very helpful for us to put that in perspective.
To put a quantum on it. For an adult, it will be more like £800, unlimited golf.
Well, you know, if the English are listening, that's pretty much what we're paying in Scotland.
Yeah,
pretty much. They're paying more in England, and we're going to get America on the next episode of the podcast, and we'll explore what they're paying. Are there many different types of courses to play? Are there nine-hole courses? Are there family clubs? Are there tournament venues? Is there the broad range down there? Because somebody said to me last week about, you know, in Australia, said there's a huge variety of golf that you can experience. It's not just the, you know, 18-hole tournament venue.
In the early 90s, South Africa started building the golf estates. Silver Lakes was the second one that was ever built. So obviously golf happened before that extensively. So there's the old school golf courses, the Royal Johannesburgs and the Royal Cape and Durban Country Club and all those, which are standalone golf courses, which aren't housing estates. And then you've got all the other, you've probably got 40, 50, 60, I think there's 50 golf estates, which are the Fang Courts, the Arabella, the Zimbalis, the Silver Lakes, and so on. And those golf courses are very economically strong because they've got the homeowners propping up the course. So it's a different financial model, and it means the golf course is never at risk.
Very good. And we're finding good conditions there now, are we? A consistent playing conditions? The greenkeepers are in place?
I mean, the quality of the playing conditions in South Africa are... The guys are spoiled. They play on bent grass greens, kukuyu fairways, predominantly. You know, I'm saying 90% of the time, bent grass greens running at 10, 11 on the stimp meter day in, day out. Perfect conditions. In the summer months, the bent grass takes a bit of a takes a little strain, but it's not too bad. And in the winter time, it gets really quick. Even quicker, and greens can be running at 12 on a daily basis. So again, I think that's why South Africa produces so many top players, is because the conditions that the lads grow up playing in are like the conditions that they're exposed to when they play professional golf. South African Golf Association does an amazing job. Golf RSA does an amazing job with the structures of tournaments. Really strong year-round opportunities for the youngsters to compete, top tournaments. And then the international guys, the French guys, my son was playing in the SA Amateur Stroke Play Championships about a month ago, and the French and Scottish and Indian, and I think there was four national teams playing in the tournament. So the international guys come down here because of the flip season. It's our summer when it's your winter. And the quality of tournaments and the quality of golf courses and the quality of playing conditions, they all come down here to compete with the South African boys. And a French boy won that one, actually. He was about 23 under.
Andrew, in terms of course conditions and turf management to achieve those conditions, my remit at SRUC is sustainability in golf course management. So that's sort of my area of passion. What is sustainability in South Africa in regards to turf management? How is that sort of being taken on board, or how is that being considered, and what does it look like in implementation? I'm assuming it's similar to here, but I'm wondering if there are any sort of unique differences.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious ones, the golf clubs need to run profitably. The machinery costs down here are, because of the exchange rate and the import duties, are off the charts. So there's a lot of recycling of machinery. When I say that, it's like refurbishment of machineries, machinery. And the growing conditions are pretty good. So it's water management in the winter months. We get so much water and rainfall in the summer months. I mean, we've had like 700 millimeters of rain this year already, in this calendar year.
Is any golf courses collecting rainwater harvesting? Is that taking place?
Yeah, they've all got their dams and their irrigation dams, and they've got different layers to that. But to what extent they do that would be a financial topic for each club to deal with. But obviously, we would love to store the water better. I mean, in about 2 weeks from now, the rains will stop completely, and it won't rain here again until mid-October at all. Yeah. So, but so water management is important, especially in the winter, and then managing stress in the summer heat on the greens, machinery maintenance, staying on top of, because it's not affordable to replace that might be slightly different. The controls on usage of pesticides and fertilizers and that sort of thing may be a little bit more flexible here. Less red tape, but they obviously, everyone's still, again, because of the currency, the rand, and buying these things, you still need to use them responsibly financially, never mind environmentally.
I think what you said about the refurbishing of machinery is that rings true here, but it's maybe more of a refurbishing machinery and then passed on to sort of maybe smaller clubs with a lower budget and stuff. So that machinery is getting reused, but perhaps in a different way. So it's just interesting to hear about the sort of different approaches to sustainability.
It was Andrew that said something that I've always remembered and always used myself. I've claimed credit for it myself quite a few times, is that of all the issues around sustainability, it's economic sustainability that isn't understood enough. And it was Andrew that said that. And I'll never forget it, Andrew. And I think you're absolutely spot on. We can talk about sustainability all day long, but economic sustainability has to be at people's minds.
I mean, there's like in any business, a golf course wants to keep going. You know, it doesn't have an end goal, a golf course. You know, you can set yourself goals to improve this season and do some projects for this season. But the end goal of a golf course is not to the golf course to win. It's not like to be number one course in the world or anything. I think golf course rankings are so subjective. The idea of a golf course is to keep going, and they must run it in all sorts of ways to make sure it keeps going. There's a great guy on social media called Simon Sinek. You'll probably know him.
Yeah.
And he's got a book called The Infinite Game. And when I read it, I thought about golf courses as a business. We're not trying to build a golf course so we can sell it or win a prize. We're running a golf course so we can keep it running.
So it'll be here in 100 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good, if your sustainability agenda for your own club is based on, let's hope this golf course is here in 100 years, that's a good way to go about it.
Thank you for the recommendation on the book. We're going to put that link into the podcast summary of this, because it's a great book. It's a great book, and it gets you to really think.
You mentioned,
yeah. It's on my Audible, and I've read it twice, I think, because we've used it in our curriculum. Going back a little bit to something you said, I was speaking to Cork yesterday, a golf club in Cork, and they were celebrating the fact that people are enjoying the golf course who are not necessarily playing golf. That's a theme that we want to continue. And you paint a picture down there of Silver Lakes and I don't know how many estates you said South Africa's got now, but these are people that are living in a golf course environment, which is by definition a naturally beautiful environment. They're not necessarily playing golf, right? They're just enjoying that environment, and they're contributing to the rural economy by simply living there, right?
20% of the homeowners of Silver Lakes play golf.
80% are enjoying the environment without playing golf. I think this is taking it to another level. I'm loving the golf course so much, I'm going to live on it, but I'm not going to play it.
You sometimes hear the argument from those guys, let's close the golf course and just have a green environment. And I'm like, my argument to that is, my comeback to that one is, who pays for the upkeep of the green environment? You know, the golfers are giving you an amazing green environment by paying their green fees and their memberships, and you just have to give them a little bit of respect. And you can't tee off here after 4 o'clock off the first tee, which I find very sad, because they say, no, it's time for the homeowners to be able to enjoy the golf course. And then I'm going to get into some of our debates around the board table when I was the director of golf here. The chairman at the time wasn't a golfer, and he said to me, no, the guys must be allowed to play cricket and hockey and tennis and throw a rugby ball and throw it on the golf course. And I said to him, okay, so they are allowed, you can play cricket on the golf course and you can play rugby on the golf course, but you can't play golf on the golf course. So I was like, man, that's crazy. But it's there's a little bit of give and take in these environments, and you just got to, give and take a bit.
I'm trying to get my head wrapped around that. You know, you live around a golf course, but you don't want to see any golf after 4 p.m. What motivates these folks to buy property in this area? Is it just because it is such a lovely sort of natural environment?
There's the perceived crime story in South Africa, and there's been many, many security estates built where imagine if you entered St. Andrews, and it was a boomed off environment, and you could only get into St. Andrews if you had a fingerprint. That's the environment we live in, and many of that.
Okay.
It's security and lifestyle, and it's been a huge success. I live on the estate, and I love living here.
I know you do. You tell me enough times. Yeah.
Those thunderstorms haven't arrived yet. I was hoping that you would hear some. Let's see how far away they are.
We're going to let you go back to your wonderful lifestyle because that's our time up. I won't ask you what you're going to do this afternoon, but I'm sure it'll be pleasurable because you live the golf lifestyle, Andrew. We look up to you because you live the golf lifestyle. And golf, for me anyway, and I think for Ben, golf is a lifestyle. And you personify that. And thank you so much for sharing your love and your journey. And I know we're going to meet you again on this podcast because we want your views, you know, on a range of topics, across the sustainability agenda. So thank you so much for your time.
I was going to say, Andrew, you have to come back because two questions I wanted to ask, we'll get to next time, is one, how do we set up a South African wine, Scotch whiskey exchange? And two, I need some dirt on Mr. Butcher. So we'll have to talk again about Tales of Mr. Butcher.
Just let me quickly answer the first one.
We're editing there.
Right. Oh, yeah.
No. I'm in charge of editing. You're good, Andrew. Let's hear it.
The first one.
So the first one, the Cape Town vineyards, it's just an amazing experience. If you go to the south of France, I went like hunting for a vineyard experience like you get in South Africa. If you go to Franschhoek, which is like the town in the heart of the winelands of Stellenbosch, of the Western Cape, you can jump on a tram and you can go on a wine tasting tour and have different, all you can go on like to six different, this is Ian Butcher's dream. So you jump on the tram in Franschhoek, you go to visit six or seven vineyards, you have lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the different vineyards, and you taste the wines. You get fairly tipsy, and it's just the most beautiful setting. France haven't commercialized it like that. They will at some point. I'm sure they will.
That sounds like a great experience. You bolt on a round of golf in there. That sounds like a pretty good day.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two or three more than two or three amazing golf estates in that area as well.
I repeat what I said. It's a lifestyle. Thank you for finishing on that high note, Andrew. Thank you so much again for your time. We're going to see you again. And good luck to your young boy. And good luck to your young boy, by the way.
SA Boys Championships next week.
Fantastic. Wish him well from all of us here. And maybe we'll get him on the podcast and ask him what he thinks. Thanks, Andrew. Okay, Ben, wasn't it a delight to talk to Andrew McKenna down there in South Africa? Before we start reflecting on the wine tours with a tram.
Sign me up.
I think there was one essential takeaway from this. Having been down to South Africa in the sort of early 2000s, I've witnessed a journey that Andrew was describing, which for I won't call it a developing country of golf, but there's been a journey of discovery for South African golf, which Andrew has significantly contributed to, is the understanding that for the golf industry as a whole within a country to develop, it needs high quality golf courses, well-conditioned golf courses, optimum conditioned golf courses. And that's what he's describing down there in South Africa. I don't think there was always that understanding, but there is now. And as a result of that golf course conditioning, you're getting a production line of players, and both in terms of high quality players, but also in terms of growing numbers of participation. Participation will always depend on the quality of the surfaces people play on and want to come back to. And that direction Andrew is leading on down there with now a qualification structure in South Africa that produces the future course managers.
the results are obvious, aren't they? In the way he spoke about those concepts, Ian. Andrew McKenna, though, what a guy. Like, I don't think I've ever met anybody who's enjoying their life so much. I mean, fantastic to get to talk to someone who's in such a good place. It rubs off on you. I felt great that whole afternoon after the chat with Andrew. And one of the things that he said that I wanted to mention here in the summary is that the sustainability thing, it's very important, you know, however you want to frame that, environmentally friendly or ESG or whatever we want to look at. Sustainability's got to make sense across a number of pillars. And environmental conservation or protection, important, yep. Growing the game and treating the workforce right, yep, absolutely, social sustainability. But it has to be financially sustainable as well.
Yes.
If we do all those other things to the detriment of finances, then that organization or business is going to cease to operate. And I think sometimes people are a little bit afraid to talk about the importance of the financial sustainability, but we can't ignore it. And if a business isn't making money, then it's going to disappear. And as Andrew said, if you're getting all the things right around sustainability, then that business should be there 100 years down the road. And if it's 100 years down the road, if it's there, then you've obviously got sustainability right.
No, I think you're so right. I think our curriculum will emphasize the importance of financial sustainability, you know, as being absolutely core. And it is, as you say, it's great to touch base with people like Andrew who are living that. They're not just living that, but they're living the lifestyle of golf. And the whole point of this podcast is to introduce the audience to people who are, you know, the golf is in their blood, you know, and they're living a great lifestyle because they're contributing to the game. And Andrew's a great ambassador for his own program, but he's a great ambassador for that part of the world. And I think it's fair to say we're going to invite him back for a little bit more of that sunshine talk. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of happiness in this industry, and I don't think people are aware of that. So it's worth checking out, definitely. And hopefully we can bring more people's awareness around to that.
Exactly. We look forward to welcoming our audience again and to explore more happiness in the next episode. And we'll see you all next week on The First Tee.